Welcome to Kidlit Happy Hour. Grab a drink, cozy up,
and explore storytelling with creative minds inside children's publishing and beyond.
Hi, Joanna.
Oh my gosh. Hey, Caroline.
Joanna, it seems to me that there's something worth mentioning that may or may not be happening today. Is there something on your mind tickling your brain?
Yes. Thoughtful question. Okay, everyone. We're stupid. So today is the day that We Who Produce Pearls, an anthem for Asian America, is released into the world.
Oh, my gosh.
I can't believe it's today. I feel like I've been looking forward to this day for several years, and it's finally here. And it's really exciting and a little nerve-wracking because I have learned that books take on a life of their own, and some don't have very exciting lives, and some have exciting lives. And I'm just really hopeful that this one has an exciting life.
Oh,
but I just know so much is out of my control, but I'm really proud of it. I think that Amanda Pomodopakia's art is just phenomenal. And I really hope it finds a lot of readers and that it becomes a springboard for learning about our history, the history of Asians in America. And I know I mentioned this last time, but we called it an anthem for Asian America because it really would be a dream for it to be something that people are reading and quoting and displaying or performing. You know, I have big dreams like in all the spaces throughout our community, even beyond our community, because it is also about solidarity. I'm really proud of it. And I hope it finds people. I hope people
find it. Y'all, and also from the perspective of the reader, it's so effing gorgeous. It's one of those books that you read, and as you're reading, you're like, I didn't know a book could do this. I remember as I was reading, I thought, there's nothing like this I've ever been a part of as a reader. Each word is so heavy and rich, and it's dripping and honey. And to read through and let yourself get lost into the poetry and then get to the end and recognize, especially for me, where I've had less of an education on Asian America, to recognize.
For everyone, not just you.
Right. I mean, I remember witnessing you. I was helping you put books away in the library. I think I've told the story once on the show. And as you were listening to one of the many source books that informed your understanding of the history, and you were processing this history you never learned, and the anger it felt to not have been taught that, and then the vindication that so much of your intuition around your identity was fact-checked by all of your ancestors, and watching you process this history in real time and then turn that into something that's so triumphant. The experience of getting to be on the other side and soaking in your language, realizing how much meaning each sentence has and how you can explode that out and education for kids and adults and how revolutionary it can be is just, if you think that I am overdoing it and you're thinking, wow, that Caroline, she's one hyperbolous motherfucker. I would tell you, challenge me. I dare you to go buy this book and tell me you don't agree. It's so powerful. That's all I got. That's all I got, y'all. Just go enjoy it.
Thank you.
It's really you. Really
say everyone needs a Caroline to be their hype woman. Because
okay, but again, whatever, sure.
I think that, thank you for all the beautiful things you said. I really think I have been profoundly changed in the process of creating this book. Like, I have such a deeper understanding of who I am and who I want to be and what I want our community to be, and a sense of responsibility in shaping our world and my community in that way. So I guess you just have to read it. Please go buy the book.
Go buy the
book. All the copies. Anywhere, give them to everyone you know. Today is also the day that I start going on various activities. And the first one is we are on our way to Texas, where we're going to see each other in person at TLA.
Excited. So TLA, Texas Library Association. We are on our way. It's one of the biggest conferences because it's Texas. And the fact that you get to be here or there on the day the book is being launched, and you're going to be in community with so many other writers and librarians and readers. Woo! And me.
And you. I mean, forget everyone else.
We were talking before we started recording, and I'm like, yeah, what's your hotel? She's like, oh, it's so-and-so. And I'm like, cool, cool. I don't have one yet. She's like, uh-huh.
Well, I need a place to sleep, everyone.
I do. And that place is your bed. So yes. I'll bring my earplugs because I'm such a sensitive sleeper.
I forgot about that.
That's why.
I grind my teeth. There's four stories from Caroline's in-laws about what happens when she sleeps.
Okay, around. This is officially my first conference after being published. I went to a few SCBs. I know. So I get to be on a panel on Thursday, and then I'm doing a book signing Thursday morning at the Simon & Schuster booth. And I want to put out there that who knows if anyone will get the book and get it signed. But if you're listening to this, if you see me there, would you please come over and say hi for the love of all things good to, I think, 9:30 or 10 on Thursday. Please, for my heart, just come pretend to be in line.
We'll in Caroline's line at Simon & Schuster.
Please, you could bring anything, a napkin. I'll just sign whatever, but just talk to me.
Caroline has this idea that she's going to be a hermit at this conference. And I keep telling her she's going to see all these people that she knows that hasn't met in person yet. And Caroline is the most entertaining and fun person to be around pretty much ever. And anyways, please go visit her.
Do you know anything about your schedule, Joe?
I probably do, but I haven't looked it up yet.
Okay. Well, go check our social. You'll see when all of her stuff is.
Anyways, we're excited. Really quickly. So I'm going on tour after Texas. I have several events in the Bay Area. Then we are going to Minnesota, Atlanta, New York, DC, Baltimore. So if you are around any of those places, I would really love to see you at an event. All the information is up on my social, on my Instagram. So please go.
Ooh, this is an exciting time. This has been a long time. And exciting time.
I know. I'm really excited to be doing everything with Amanda. Y'all, Amanda is such a force. She's such a badass.
And this is her first picture book because she's an artist. In so many different mediums. So I can't wait to hear her talk about what that's been like to move from murals, all the really interesting. Yeah.
And not always a good way, but I really am mostly excited to be on tour with her. And what we're doing at every event is we've invited local artists, activists, educators, authors to come be in conversation with us about our book, but more broadly about the Asian American community, about what we need, what our possibilities, where we've been, who we are, all those things. And we have such amazing people that we are going to get to talk to at every stop. Also, last thing I'm going to say is that there are so many other books that are speaking to the reclaiming of the narrative and the histories of Asians in America. So I just bought Supriya Kalkar's book. It's a beautiful picture book about this super famous diamond that is now sitting in the crown in England, but it's from India, all the things. Christina Sundarvat has a really beautiful young readers edition of Dr. Erica Lee's groundbreaking book about the history of Asians in America. And that's coming out on the 30th. So, so many things just in time for May. Mm-hmm. We're going to do lots of different events coming up together. We have a panel at NCTE. We're doing an IG Live, but it feels good to be in community.
Yes.
Writing these stories. And I think a lot about how we work in community and we lift and rise together. That's how we rise. And it's in this idea of feeling like we're in competition with each other. Yes. It only serves to bring us down because the world really does need all of the stories and they all work so well together. And so why would we feel like if one book does well, ours can't do well? Yeah. Really, they should all do well because we need all of them.
There'd be a way to approach that from a scarcity mindset and siloing them further, which would reduce their collective impact. And I'm hearing you say, together, we all rise. And what a moment. This wouldn't have been the case
great.
A decade ago, 5 years ago.
2 years ago. Yeah.
Yeah.
Christine is a middle grade book. Mine's a picture book. Supriya's is a picture book. There's a graphic novel that's out by Third State Books. That also goes through the history of Asians in America. They all could be used together. And it's awesome because you need all the books to speak to all the readers, you know?
I love that. Anyways,
and so our episode today is with one Emily Lyman. I'm so excited for you to hear from her. One note is that she is my sister-in-law and she's fabulous. We recorded this last fall when both she and Caroline were pregnant.
I think it was in August or September.
Summer. Yeah, late summer. Before both of their worlds turn back upside down. I feel like her perspective on building audience or connecting to audience is one that is also super fascinating and has helped me to think through a lot of different things. I think about it a lot.
I loved getting to know someone who's so close to your life and who has such an expertise with wisdom to share. I loved the conversation.
Yeah. Okay. So enjoy.
Enjoy.
Welcome, Emily Lyman. We are so excited to have you here.
For those of you who don't know who Emily is, I'm going to share with you because once you hear this, you are going to want to know her. Emily spent nearly a decade working in-house with global publishers such as Penguin Random House and Simon & Schuster, managing both corporate and title marketing initiatives. So if you've been in the industry a while, it's possible she has helped support your books. Since her time in publishing, and because she is a total badass, she went on to start her own company. And today she is the CEO and founder of Branch and Bramble, a digital marketing company. As an award-winning data artist, which we are going to ask her about later, Emily specializes in blending data with heart and values to create meaningful audience connections to brand partners, which include, you might have heard of them, Patagonia, Paramount, and as I mentioned before, Penguin Random House. She's worked with companies with household names to individual authors just trying to get their books out in the world. And of important note, she is my sister-in-law, and I'm super excited to pick her brain about all of this. I'm kicking myself for not tapping into this wealth of knowledge many, many years ago. She has also recently, as a fun fact, added Innkeeper to her long list of accomplishments as she's been roped into running the Mountain Brook Inn in the Catskills in upstate New York with my brother, and it's gorgeous, and they're renovating everything themselves, and everyone should go visit. Welcome, Emily.
Emily, welcome. I'm so excited to finally get to meet you and hear more about your story and connect. So welcome a million times over.
Okay, before we jump happy hour. Sorry,
Emily.
No worries.
We just want to know what you're drinking.
Okay. So it's such a pleasure to be here. I'm very excited. Thank you both for having me. Okay. I will admit that I like trying TikTok things, and Joanna, I blame your brother for the fact that I'm on TikTok so much, but I am drinking an adrenal cocktail.
Ooh, say more.
What is that? How do you spell that?
It's nothing. It's not exciting. It's not an actual cocktail. We apparently suffer from adrenal fatigue as humans, and so it's literally just a cocktail of orange juice and coconut water and salt, and other people add other things to it like collagen. There's so many different recipes out there, but it's supposed to just, you know, we call it our brain juice. We've done a lot of research into it. And of course, the medical community, and Joanna knows this because so many of her cousins are actual doctors who went to very top prestigious school. So don't tell them that David and I are drinking this, but the medical community is like, yeah, no way. There's nothing to this. So I don't care if it's a placebo effect or whatever. I don't know. It's working for me right now.
That's all that matters. Yeah.
Okay. Emily, we're going to jump in. Our first question for you is, how do you find your audience and or help your audience find and connect with you or your clients?
That is a great question. And there are so many different ways to go about it. It's everything that you do to put yourself out there. So marketing, public relations, networking, right, Joanna, you were so good at this. I know you mentioned, you know, you wanted to pick my brain years ago, but you didn't need it. You were out there making connections with people. You were talking about what you wanted to do. You were talking to other people about what they wanted to do. So networking is a huge, huge part. And the biggest thing is, you're not going to know at a glance, like, where is my audience or who even is my audience, right? So there are a lot of different exercises you can do to sit down and go, oh, well, who do I want to be my audience? And make that hypothesis and then try to find those people, either small networking groups, if you ask your publisher, if you're going to conferences or workshops, or you're just getting on social and finding a hashtag or a keyword and deep diving into that. So for example, we're currently working with an author in the shifter romance space.
Ooh.
Yes. The first step would be get on TikTok, get on Instagram, get on Twitter, type in that hashtag, type in that keyword, and just look and see how people are talking about it, who's talking about it, what are those common interests and demographics and psychographics that you see coming up? You know, is it mostly females? Is it mostly males? Are they in a specific age range? And that's where you start. But I want to say it is not a case of build it or write it and they will come. It very much constantly changes too, right? You can find an audience and you hypothesize and then you realize, oh, actually, maybe this audience resonates more with my book. But my biggest point for authors who are starting, because I have a lot who come to me and say, I don't even know where to start, is take pen to paper and write out your hypothesis of who you think your audience is and go out and test it through searching on social media, Googling other authors who are like you, etc.
Ooh, that's really good. Let's say you're writing a really universal story. Let's say you're writing a story that's, you know, a goodnight baby story. And so you think your audience is parents of newborns, right? So that's about as big as you're going to get in the picture book space, right? Parents. So if someone were coming to you with that, like, okay, I'm just trying to find parents, how might you drill down? How might you walk us through the exercise of moving from a hypothesis to getting to something a little bit more granular?
Why don't you put the hypothesis together for me first? Because I want to know, do you think it's, you said mommy of newborns. Is it mommies of a certain age? Is it...
I might say maybe a baby shower market too. People who are gifting to families, to younger mm-hmm. families.
Grandparents maybe. Yeah. Exactly. But there's also the age range of parents too. Because the thing with audiences, you can be as broad as possible, right? You could say every single mother of a newborn in the United States. But that's just too many people and you can't start there. So oftentimes it's, okay, is it younger moms of newborns? Is it older moms of newborns? It depends on writing style. Is it more of a funky, you know, sleep children's book that talks about authoritative parenting instead of authoritarian, or it'll be more colorful and more off the cuff. So maybe you want the artsy parent. There's all these little things that you yourself are either subconsciously, I'm thinking I'm not, I am not an author, or consciously thinking when you write your book that you look at and say, oh, I think this will appeal to this type of audience. And I would caution you to say, pick one pretty narrow audience instead of really, really broad. And then, okay, so let's take that. And then we're going to say, okay, maybe our newborn baby nighttime book is kind of funny and quirky and a little bit clever and is for the baby, but also for the parent. So I think my mother is going to be between the ages of 26 and 37 or 26 and 40 or something within those ranges. And she's going to be a little bit more on the artistic, creative side. And Okay. Now I'm going to look at mommy blogs. And I'm just going to go on Instagram or I'm going to go on Google and I'm going to say, okay, what are the top mommy blogs for creatives? Or what are the top artsy mommy blogs? Mm-hmm. Just see where that takes you. And you'll start to go down this rabbit hole. And you'll start to see, oh, nope, that's not who I think it will work for. That's not who I think it, oh, I think this person it will work for. I think this one will really enjoy this book, or look at all the other books that they're posting about, or they've mentioned, or the different types of information that they are publishing. And then you can go in and say, who are they following? Influencers are always following other influencers. Mommy bloggers are always following other mommy bloggers. And then you can see what publications they start to read. And then I can start to see where my audience is. And now I'm going to determine how I'm going to meet that audience. Does it mean I'm going to get on that same platform or channel? Do they all go to a mommy conference?
Emily, whittle down to mommy really fast. Is that kind of a subconscious or explicit assumption when talking about picture books that it's women only, or that's the main user? Or was that something we just leapt into by virtue of the example?
That's just something we leapt into. And also probably just because that's where my brain is at right now.
Yeah.
Right.
I was going to say, for those of you who are unaware, Emily is, and as is Caroline, are both expecting in a few months.
I am growing a human, as I like to say. I would also say that that could be a first step. And also because it's really hard to target multiple audiences. So once you have the mommy audience figured out, then you can go to the daddy blogs. There are there. It's not that they're not. I just don't want you to say, I need to do moms and dads at the same time, because that's going to be such a huge audience and it's going to be overwhelming.
A lot of your examples currently are revolving around meeting people online or using social media to find an audience or to understand your audience. And this is a common question, particularly, I think, in author and creative circles. So can you help us, for once and for all, settle the question about whether or not we need to be on social media? Do we all need to start TikTok accounts and start dancing? What's your advice, or what are your thoughts?
I think that we gravitate towards social media as marketers because it is one of the lowest hanging fruits out there mm-hmm. for connecting with audiences. That is not to say that you have to be on social media. And I will be the first person to tell you that if you do want to be on social media, don't be on all the platforms. Pick one to start. Pick 10 to 15 minutes a day in your day that you can get to know it. That's plenty to start with. And as you get a sense of what you like, how you like it, if you like it, if you don't, you can move forward from there. There are so many other ways to meet other people as well. It really depends on how you yourself, I would say, network. Instead of going online, is it going to your local library and meeting up with play groups or reading groups or the librarians there and getting their thoughts on things and making friends? Is it about going to other parent meetups in your neighborhood? Is it talking to your neighbors? Is it talking to your family and friends who have connections? There's so many different ways to meet your audience. It becomes an exercise in what you yourself are comfortable with. The only caveat I will say is publishers are very, very much looking for authors to have a platform.
Yep.
I mean, obviously, as both of you know, getting published is a feat. It is hard. It is work. And I was in the editorial world for a hot second. And I was in the agent world for a second, right? And kind of everything around publishing.
I did not know this about you.
Oh, because it was a hot second. And it's a lot of work to get published. And anything that you can do to have a leg up is going to be beneficial. And a lot of that sometimes looks like having a platform on social media.
You're someone, you wrote a book, you got lucky enough to get it published. There's an expectation that you have a platform now. I feel like the reality of how you cultivate and build and put yourself out there and your work out there is that so many professionals feel like self-promo is gross, is icky, is uncomfortable. Yeah. It's almost shame-inducing. When we talk about it, we're all like, cringing. Like, oh, you hate it. I hate it. I apologize for having to flood your feed with all this stuff.
Sorry, I have to post about my book again.
So, yeah, exactly. Like, I have another book coming out. Please bear with me. And so, curious to hear from you. Do you suggest reframing that in a certain way? Or is it not a framing question? It's another way of looking at it. How might you address an author that feels that way?
Like, or is it just gross and we just need to accept
it? Yeah, like deal with it.
What's your advice for how we should be thinking about this?
It's a little bit of both. And I actually get this question multiple times a week. I do. I would say start with reframing it in your mind as it's not you self-promoting. Rather, it's a celebration of your hard work. And don't your family and friends want to celebrate with you and to celebrate the exciting things in your life and the fruits of your hard work? That is why you have followers following. If we're talking on social media, right? Or that's why your family wants to talk to you and hear about what you're doing. Except maybe the, you know, grumpy uncle or whatever who couldn't care less. But we all have those. I'm also assuming that you're not just constantly publishing self-promotion about you. And that, I think, is the other really key part, is you don't want to push out messages 24/7, even twice a week. Maybe it's every couple of weeks or, you know, right around a book launch. You're like, okay, I have some really exciting news coming out. My feed's going to be flooded for a couple of days. And then we'll get back and you're mixing up these self-promotional messages with other very valuable content that you are contributing to the conversation, showcasing other authors, showcasing your illustrators, showcasing what else is going on in your life, the causes and purposes and values that you hold dear. So it's a way for your audience and your followers to get to know you and to celebrate with you.
It's a very loving approach.
I'm going to have to write it on my wall.
I know. I feel like
this isn't growth. This is celebration.
If it doesn't work, then yeah, suck it up and just do it anyway. But you know, the reframing doesn't work.
I feel like it's, you know, it's the classic socialization. Like, we're women socialized to not celebrate your work, to not assume the best of the people who love you and think that they're all in it with you. It's like, oh, be really small. So suddenly you're supposed to be big, take up space in a way that's filled with gratitude and owning it. And not resist that experience. So
I'm thinking about this conversation about how as women of color, as creatives, so many things, like
we feel so much pressure to always be grateful. It's like that Barbie speech from this movie. I haven't watched the movie yet, but you know, I've seen it all over online where you have to be grateful for what you have, and but you also have to be ambitious, you know, all these things. So I feel like that all collides. So there's a couple of thoughts I have. One is I really liked what you were saying before about finding your community, like whether we call it your audience, your community, whether it's the play group at the library or the folks online, that online spaces can become like community. I feel like for me anyways, that's how I'm talking to myself about it, is the celebration piece is real. I do notice actually more engagement on posts where I'm like, hey, good news, which is sometimes surprising, like, oh, people really are celebrating, even though it's this online space that's not real. And I do feel like if you think about online spaces as community, as like finding people who believe or have the same values or same interests, and when we post online, it's less about self-promo and more about finding and building community, that helped me sometimes. But my other question is, do you find that creatives, like authors and illustrators in particular, feel this hesitance about self-promo or community building and celebration? Or is that just like a something that you observe across the board?
It is across the board for brands that are tied to an individual. So your book is part of your brand, but you, Joanna Ho, are the brand. You, Caroline, are the brand. And companies, no problem, right? That's their whole goal, their whole job. That's what they want to do. In fact, getting them to scale back is the trouble that we have. But when it's an individual personal brand, that is where we run into this a lot. And I love, Joe, how you phrase it as community. And that's exactly what it is. You are building that community, whether it's online, whether it's in person. And the important thing is when you think about community, you're not thinking about just constantly taking from community.
Yeah.
You're thinking about how do I give back to that community? How do I add value to that community? And so that's a perfect way of saying that when I said you're celebrating in their successes as well. You're commenting on others, you're liking their stuff, you're giving them congratulations. And so you're doing the same thing too. And Caroline, you mentioned taking up space. And I love that on LinkedIn, and I apologize, I do not remember her name, but she is a female businesswoman and she had professional headshots done. And she was like, you know, I started and they were just posing me so weird. And I like the general normal womanly poses, right? And I said, I want to take up space. Pose me like you would a man. And her headshots were just awesome. They were fabulous. So the next time you're posing for author photos, author headshots, take up space, feel that confidence.
Yeah.
Every time you look at that photo, that picture, you're going to be like, yeah, I am a badass.
I love that.
I love that too.
I felt myself internally bristle when you said, Joanna, you're the brand. I was like, no, Joanna's a brand. Like, no, she's a brilliant. But you're exactly right, right? And I think that's the hard thing to grapple with is, you know, so many people are writing the stories. It's about the story we want to get out there. And suddenly we're thrust into being the conduit between the story getting to kids. And so I need to hold myself in that regard or whatever that means. But in what ways do you feel like marketing is or isn't like storytelling?
I would actually say that good marketing is storytelling.
Say more. Carry on.
It's what every marketer strives to do, is we strive to tell the brand story. Whether that brand is Joanna, whether it's Caroline, whether it's Penguin Random House, whether it's, you know, Patagonia, every brand, personal, corporate, has a story. And good, successful marketing tells that story. So it's not the brand started in 1989, right? You kind of get that on their about page, but it's told through tone of voice. It's told through the type of content that you decide to share. It's told through, we'll say in Patagonia in this way, how they decide to interact and give voice to the values and societal issues that they find important. It's through all of those things that really good, successful marketing is done.
How do people who are multifaceted, I mean, I would think corporations probably are similar in some ways, but like as individuals, we contain so many multitudes and our stories contain so many different things and different themes, different, yeah. You know, one might be fantasy, different genres, different age groups. How does one figure out the story that you tell when finding an audience or building a community?
Not pulling any punches today, Joe.
No, like I need all the advice, Emily.
Hurry, tell me now.
I would say it is a very personal decision for personal brands. And we've worked with authors across the gamut, right? Scientific, nonfiction authors, romance authors, children book authors, you name it. And one, they all ask about the self-promotion question. And two, they all usually will come and say, I don't feel comfortable sharing this online, or I don't feel comfortable sharing this with the public. And so you have to start out with that exercise of who do I want to present?
Yeah.
Who do I want to be online? And who do I want to hold for myself, for my family instead? And I'm going to give a little bit of potentially controversial thought, which is the whole talk about authenticity is crap. Like whenever people are like, be authentic, be yourself, yeah. It is putting a very great pressure on individuals and brands to feel like they owe their community, they owe their online audience something, and you don't. So it's not that you can't be, you need to be transparent about the things that you want to be and have decided to be transparent about. You need to be honest. You need to have integrity. You need to have dignity. But this whole rhetoric around authenticity is infuriating to me as a marketer. So,
fascinating.
I'm sorry, I got on my soapbox.
No, I'm like, I love that soapbox. Carry on the soapbox, please.
I love it. I always think about too, Emily, like the moment that you have an experience, a lived or a thought or whatever, you're in the authentic moment. And then you decide, I should translate that on my phone, right? Like people would like this, or, oh, I really want to share this. Something in that passageway, we're losing a bit of the true authenticity of whatever you experience. There are no two ways about it. And so I think pretending that's not real, that we have the seamless flow of lived experience that we're then sharing and like, this is me. And I was sitting there wondering what color to pick of the font and like where to put it. You know what I mean? Like that's a little bit of bullshit. And I appreciate you naming that.
My brain went, I was like, uh-huh.
Okay. I'll get back to how do you decide what to share and what do you decide to put out there? It's going to be different for everybody. One, right. If they're like, I don't want to share anything about my family. I don't want to put my kids' faces online. These things are off limits for me. That's the first step. The second step is, how polarizing do you want to be? How controversial do you want to be? How much do you want to share about your opinions? There's no right or wrong answer. I will say that generally studies have shown, take it or leave it as anyone wants to, that when you share your values, your audience is more loyal. You find that deeper community that you're looking for because quite often, I'm going to try to please everybody.
Right.
It doesn't work. And it actually ends up being boring content.
Can you tell more about that, Emily?
Yes.
That for a second and dig in before we go back broad. Because I think a lot of people are very hesitant. It's just like a concern for everyone.
Right.
And then authors and writers and creatives who are putting themselves out there through their work, I think that impacts one, the kind of work they put out. And then of course, what they're putting on social media relatedly. Can you just like say more about this tension between wanting to reach a universal audience versus wanting to be authentic versus the hesitance or desire to share true opinions about political or controversial or potentially hot topic divisive things?
If I could boil it down, even though it's a very complex, lots of different strings and threads to pull there, it boils down again to what you want your brand to be, but also how much you want to be involved in it when you get into those things. And I will say, there is no wrong answer. And as much as we pressure ourselves and we feel the pressure from a lot of different spots, from society, from publishers, from stakeholders, from family, the thing I like my authors to come back to time and time again is this is your community and your audience, and you are doing the work and you are putting yourself out there. And at every step of the way, you need to be comfortable with it. So if it is not comfortable for you, do not do it. I don't care if your publisher is like, you have to do this. They're politely decline. Trust me, publishers bend over backwards to make sure authors are happy. I don't know if that's an insider kept secret, but the number of internal meetings that we have had, it's like, nope, the author doesn't like this. So don't feel
like,
that
is that so?
It is, for the most part, right? And I know, and that's really simplifying it. But because it comes down to some of the hard choices you have to make, if you want to get political or take stands, you just have to be prepared for that to polarize your audience. And you have to be prepared for online trolls, and you have to be prepared for everything that comes with that from a very practical standpoint. And you have to be prepared of how you're going to handle comments, how you're going to respond, how you're going to do pushback. And I've had authors who say, I just don't want any part of that. I don't want to do with that. That's not how I want to spend my time. And that's an okay answer too. It is okay to build a more universal audience and find yourself and find your place that doesn't involve battling trolls of that nature and constantly weighing in on these hot topic, you know, hot button issues.
I fully hear that, especially when you're describing the flow from publisher pressure to be a certain way or to present a certain way. I'm nodding my head vigorously. I also think there's a nuance for every identity group, but coming at it from a white author perspective, when we talk about sitting in comfort versus discomfort, something that's coming up for me is this idea of being a white author and prioritizing my comfort would mean not engaging in a lot of these conversations and sitting back. And I do feel a push that I think there's a responsibility for white authors in particular who are taking up space disproportionately in an industry to know the truth of that, to understand the facts, to get the space you're taking up, and then to make a plan to do something about it. Because if we're going to be taking up resources, financing, PR dollars, all of it, like prioritizing our comfort doesn't feel like it's moving the needle at all. I've been way quieter on social media with my own personal stuff going on, but I'm constantly thinking, like, what do you do with that, right? Like, as a white author, what am I doing behind the scenes? If being out front isn't the way, what am I doing to make a meaningful, I don't know, something with the platform that I have? So just want to throw that in the conversation.
I think it's very important. And I, at the same time, will say that is a personal choice that you are deciding on, right? As much as I want every single white woman to stand up there and talk about the space that they are taking up just because of the automatic privilege that they are born with, the reality is they're not all going to do that, right? It's not for me. It's not for us, at least now we're getting really political, but as a marketer, it's not for me to push them to take that stand. So we love to work, and we, in our client, you know, vetting process, when we bring on a potential client or a potential partner, we have those key things that we look for because we want to work with brands and individuals who have strong purpose and strong values. But at the end of the day, it is very much a personal choice how they will use their platform.
Yeah. On your website, it's on the Branch and Bramble website, which, folks, we will link if you want to learn more. We can say more about that later. But I really am curious, and I appreciate what it said here. It said, gone are the days when people simply bought and owned things for the sake of having them. Instead, modern consumerism is now defined by the values that services and goods stand for and the causes they support. So what I'm hearing too is, like, for each person, each company, it's an individual choice. It also sounds like from a marketing perspective, your company, though, is one that is searching for and that works specifically with people who are willing to put it out there, to, like, state their values and state the causes and be clear about those things. So why is that the marketing path that you chose? Like, I fully understand why you can't force someone. And I'm like,
of course.
Yeah, I'm totally on board with everything Caroline said. And from a marketing perspective, it feels like you are also taking the stand in terms of the types
you choose to work with.
Yeah. You want to work with, like, why are those types of people and corporations, the folks that you've worked with?
That's what I choose as a person personally, right? If I'm going to be here, you know, god awful amounts of time during the week, I love my company. I love my team. Let's be honest. You know, it's It's a lot of time that I'm spending, and I want it to make a difference. I want it to have meaning and purpose. And there's so many ways you can think about it. You can think about it from the heart and what I think is right and what I think needs to happen in the world. It's also because I see what my husband goes through, right, Joe? I see what David goes through when we're out and about, and he's like, that person just looked at me weird, and I'm more conscious of that. And so how can I be a part of changing that? Some people say I have a corporate edge to me. So just leaning into that corporate edge a little bit is the data and numbers that back it up, right?
Yeah.
Good marketing.
Yeah. I was just going to ask you to share that.
Values.
Yeah. Fascinating, when you told me the other day.
I actually won an award that was titled The Data Artist. So thank you.
You're all about the award. I want to hear all about it.
I have to give my team credit because they're the ones that nominated me and they wrote the pitch and it's all there doing their wordsmith experts. But essentially, we as an agency.
Wait, hold on. No. Yes, thank you to the team, but also way to not own your own awesome. About why they nominated you and why.
Yeah, wow, you're like, oh, you it was everyone but me.
I know. Everyone else did it but me. We're just going to backtrack there for a second and say, Emily, as I said earlier, is a badass and she won this awesome award. Carry on. Tell us about the award.
Thank you. Okay, you're right. I own that. That was me kind of falling into that good girl syndrome. But yes, I have worked my whole career looking at numbers and data, and I really do believe that it is part art and part science, because you can look at numbers, but if you don't understand the story behind them of what they're trying to say, then they become meaningless. And
right.
I just look at Patagonia, right? Their revenue numbers back it up. They take stance after stance after stance. They lose followers. They have trolls commenting like, oh my God, how could you do this? How could you stand for pro-choice, et cetera? They have cultivated a cult-like loyal following. Nike did it with Colin Kaepernick. You want to look on the other side, Chick-fil-A did it, right?
Sure.
So it's less about, we're not getting into which values, which companies are supporting at this moment. We're just looking at when you have values, when you stand for them, your audience becomes more loyal, they spend more money, and they're stickier. So that also just gets into empathetic marketing, which you asked me about earlier.
Can you talk about that just for a little?
I've already got it tied in. So a neuroscientist by the name of Antonio Damasio, he shared, we are not thinking machines that feel. We are feeling machines that think. So we actually cannot make decisions without feeling. So every single decision that we make, we might think it's logical, but every single decision we make has an underlying emotional buying motivator. And then under those, what we call those buying motivators, is a value. So studies have shown that there are 56 core human values across the board. Surveys have been done across many, many years, across thousands and thousands and thousands of people, and they've come up with 56 core human values. So you can tie every single decision we make into one of those values.
So what does that have to do with emotional, what was that, empathetic?
Empathetic marketing. The idea there with empathetic marketing is that it recognizes, it understands, and it appeals to the emotions and the values that are driving the buying decisions. So when I'll just take Patagonia again for another example, right? And does everyone know that Patagonia publishes books?
They do now.
Everyone needs to know that they publish books. They have authors doing signings, right? And we'll just take this because I think it's a very apropos example. But they posted an Instagram post about one of their authors. And they just said, oh, this author, so-and-so, is going to be at the Patagonia Los Angeles location at this time. And they're signing their book title. And we took that and we looked at that and go, why would anybody really click on this? And if you double click into the underlying values of Patagonia customers. Essentially, one of the core human values for all their consumers is they value experiences.
Yep.
So we took that, and that value ties into a buying motivator. There are 9 high impact buying motivators, and one of those is feeling a thrill. Mm-hmm. So if you take, hey, my buying motivator is feeling a thrill because I value experiences, and now you put that information and you craft a new Instagram caption and you go, hey, do you think climbing is worth dying for? This author is the only climber who survived a lack of oxygen deprivation at this many feet for this long. Come see him and hear his story at this author event. Double digit increase in engagement, right? Just on the 2 different posts. So that is how you take empathetic marketing, and you can get really into the weeds about it. But at the end of the day, it's looking at all of your communications that you send out and going, does this tell the story from the brand side, or does this tell the story from my consumer side? Does it talk about what they value? Which hopefully the 2 values align, right? But again, back to self-promotion, it's not so much about me, 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 me. It's really about I'm serving my community, and how do I make sure that happens every step of the way?
Emily, I'm noticing as you're talking, I think that goes into a way more intuitive place for an individual who's doing self-promo or whatever we'll call it. Like our intuition around our own feelings and how we hope to connect to other people and what that common ground is, that feels more in the direction of community and less in the direction of gross and all the gross shoulds, like the time, the place, please show up. I don't want to be alone at this bookstore. Please buy my books. Like that's way more in the bucket of, I feel like must operate this way in order to exist as an author that connects with my reader. So I think that's encouraging. It's like lean into your intuition, lean into what feels good and what your values are, because that's where you're going to get traction that leads to people showing up and engaging.
Absolutely. I would also say too, that listen to your community, right? Maybe you go to another author's event who is similar to you, or you have the same audience or something of that nature, and you just sit and listen. You don't talk. It's not about you. You listen to what they're talking about, and you listen to the values and the problems and the challenges and the pain points that they are bringing up. And that also gives you insight into them. Because I will say, yes, you want to lean into your values. And just a caveat there, there are other studies that show that we as people are really, really bad at predicting other people's emotional decisions, because of our explicit and implicit bias. But once we're aware of those, we can then better connect with our audience and better connect our values to their values and how they want to be seen and heard.
In my head, I'm like, here's the plug for everyone. You need to go out and do some anti-racist equity to understand your own bias. I'm going to find a way to get it in there somehow. Mm-hmm. Oh my gosh. These are the things I would love, Emily. One, I would love for you to come back and teach me all about all of those 9 markers are, and then those 56 emotional core things. I also was a psych major. This stuff is so fascinating. Forget how it's going to actually help me do non-gross things like community online. But it's just so fascinating how humans think and how we work.
Connect. Right? Yep.
And how people have, and it's a little bit scary to think about how people who actually have the funds and the dollars can pay very smart people like Emily to understand how people work and get us to buy things, which we're all trying to tap into because we would like you all to read our books. But before we close, if people are interested in learning more, as I am, where can people find you? How can they reach out?
So I am on LinkedIn. For those who haven't lost their LinkedIn password, Joe.
I know. Last night I was like, yes, Emily, I can't find your bio and I lost my LinkedIn password.
So I am on LinkedIn, just at Emily Lyman, and my agency website at www.branchandbramble.com. Joe, we do have some free downloadables and resources, like an intro to social media guide and like a book influencer guide. If you're interested, I can send you those links too.
Oh, yeah.
Yes. Include in show notes or however you want to push those out, or if you think your community will find them valuable.
Yeah. And are you working with individual authors now, if anyone would like to hire you on to support their efforts?
Yes, we are working with individual authors on a number of different initiatives. So some come to us and want us to help them with jumpstarting an influencer campaign. Some just want some brand coaching. So we have some really great brand coaching options that are just, hey, I need to pick someone's strategic brain for a couple hours a month, and I have all these questions and I don't know how to start. It's more of a sit down conversation, and we kind of coach you through whatever challenges or pain points that you're struggling with and are coming up against.
Okay, love that. Thank you for sharing. Please look for her. We'll post all these things in show notes. Okay, before we close, for real, it's happy hour. And they're never complete without an overshare. So if you would be so willing and so kind, we would love to hear an overshare, something related to your career. It could be funny, it could be serious, it could be cringy, it could be heartwarming, something people might not know.
Oh man, you know, this question is the hardest of all of them, I will be honest. But I'm not even going to go down my marketing career. I've had a lot of cringy moments and a lot of exciting moments. But mostly these days, the majority of the tiny brain space that I have left after doing a house renovation and an in renovation and growing a human and working and owning a company is all taken up by chicken anxiety. Okay. So,
we're going to need more there.
We inherited roosters. Joe, I don't know if David told you this, but when we got back from our trip to California, we were told that we had a hen. Just like our rooster had gotten married because someone thought that we needed a hen. So they dropped off a hen at our property. Like, here, now you guys have a hen, which comes with a whole lot of work. Okay. I'm now like, that's, is she eating the right? Yes. Thank you, Caroline. on one hand, I am so pleased that we are already entrenched in the community enough and people like us enough. Cause David and I think we're terrible chicken parents. Okay. Like, during the winter, we have to Vaseline their wattles and their combs. So we're like running around trying to catch them so I can slather them in Vaseline so they don't get frostbite. And I'm constantly worried every day. Like literally, I hear the rooster crow at an ungodly hour of the morning. And the only thing that goes through my mind is, thank God he's alive. Like he has survived another night.
You're okay. A true mom. I know. I'm like, just wait till that baby comes.
So we're now like watching to make sure this hen lays eggs and are the eggs healthy. I ask myself 5 million questions a day of just like, where are the chickens? I haven't seen them today. Are they okay? Did they get eaten? Oh my God. Like it's
true.
Anxiety.
Chicken anxiety.
That is true. Yes.
I can't wait to meet this chicken. I hope they have babies.
No. The chicken math is real.
Like,
2 chickens will lead to 40. I swear that is the actual math.
Did not think that I'd be having a conversation around chicken anxiety today, but that's what the overshare is for. Thank you.
I love it.
Emily, this was so fun. Thank you so much for sharing your expertise and your wisdom and your career.
Thank you. Love you. Can't wait to see you soon.
Thank you both. Thank you both.
If you enjoy this podcast, we would be so grateful if you would please take a moment to do any or all of the following things.
Follow or subscribe by tapping on the little plus sign or follow next to Kidlet Happy Hour in Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen.
And while you're there, we would love if you could leave a rating, preferably one with 5 stars, as well as a review.
And don't forget about Patreon, where you can help support production costs, ask us questions, get even more overshares, and receive a delicious thank you treat from JK Chocolate. Check out patreon.com/KidletHappyHourPodcast.
Thank you so much for being here, and we hope to see you back for the next episode.